Well, it's hard to believe it's been 31 years since the death of Kurt Cobain, the lead singer of Nirvana. I remember it well. I remember where I was standing in school when we got the news about Kurt Cobain's death, and many of us who were fans at the time were devastated. Of course, the official story is that he committed suicide. End of story, case closed, and we're all sad about it. But what if that is not true at all? What if he didn't commit suicide? What if, in fact, he was murdered? Well, that is the heart of a new book out now called To Kurt, I'm Sorry. Investigative journalist Chris Todd is really behind this book, really the writer behind this book and the investigator on this book, and he joins us now. Chris, great to have you back on the show. Welcome back.
Yeah, Clayton, good to see you. Hope you've been doing well.
I've been doing well. I have to admit, when you first reached out to me a number of months ago about this project, something you've been working on for many, many years, that I was blown away. Wait a minute. Kurt Cobain, of course, he committed suicide. That's the official narrative, right? I mean, that's the official story we've been told. Maybe you could just sort of set the stage there for us. What is the official story that we've been told all of these years later?
Yeah, and I live this too. You know, this is my generation, the 90s. This happened in 1994. Kurt's body was found on April 8th, around 8 a.m. on that Friday. And I was fed the suicide angle also, and I believed that for many years. I knew there were a couple of things that were a little strange that had come out right away. Some of the toxicology, some fingerprint results. There was some stuff that looked a little sketchy, but I never looked into it. I mean, literally probably for 28 years. So the narrative is that Kurt Cobain took a Remington Model 11 20 gauge shotgun and put it inside his mouth and took his own life.
So that's the official narrative. End of story, case closed, and we're all sad about it. There were some interesting things that sort of unfolded, though, in the weeks and days and months after it, as it related to his longtime, I guess, girl. Were they married?
They were married. They were married.
Courtney Love.
Yeah.
And then, of course, David Grohl and all of that. Maybe you can unpack a little bit of that drama that was unfolding in the months afterwards.
Sure. And that drama continued for a year to 2 years, and even almost to this day. And I know that sounds weird. There's some people that still are on the Courtney thing and Dave and Chris and the Nirvana and Geffen records and all that stuff. In the very immediate aftermath, there was a private investigator. I don't want to say his name. I'd rather just people know who he is. He had recorded Courtney. He worked for Courtney. He did documentaries, radio interviews. He really kind of spearheaded the theory that he didn't think it was a suicide. Okay. That's encompassed his whole life, even to this day. So he was really pointing a lot of fingers at Courtney, but in Joseph's book, we never point at Courtney. And in my investigation, I never say her name and never point anything at her. And that's for a few reasons, and that can be discussed possibly another time, but Joseph's book is really about his experience, what he witnessed, his journey on the entire situation.
All right, so let's talk about this Joseph Byrne. So if we look at the cover of the book, To Kurt, I'm Sorry, My 30-Year Journey of Regret, Pain, and Disaster, how did you first learn about Joseph Burns? How did you come to make his acquaintance?
Yeah, it was an interesting journey. I was brought the story by another pretty well-known private investigator by the name of Jason Jensen. I can say his name. He's a great guy, does great work. He's helped me out a lot on other cases. You can see him a lot on Fox, and he's on Court TV, News Nation. Great guy. I have a lot of respect for Jason. Jason asked me to look at the Kurt Cobain case and story. Someone had reached out to him, I think through Facebook, and I eventually got to meet these other authors, sleuths, kind of, I won't call them witnesses, let's call them investigators in their own way. And then we finally met Joseph. And there was another gentleman that we met also who has recently passed on, and that guy is described in the book, and everyone kind of knows who that is. So there were a couple witnesses, but I basically honed in on Joseph, and some other people honed in on this other gentleman. And at first, I love the story because it was 94. It's right before OJ. It's the Tupac Biggie stuff. It's John Benet. It's Waco. It's there's so much River Phoenix. There's so much in the 90s that is really that are really nostalgic to me. So I immediately said, I'm all in. You know, I'm all in. I will do whatever it takes. If Kurt was murdered, I will prove it and I will do it. You know what I'm capable of. And he said, absolutely, man. That's why we want you to run, you know? And so I spoke to Seattle PD a couple of times in the beginning, top detectives from the cold case unit. And I also went to the media and I was shut down and I knew that was going to happen. And I said, look, hey, I told Jason, I said, here we go again. You know, we've been on through this with these other cases. He goes, I know, just do you, just do what you do. And so we're here. And Joseph's been interviewed by some other sleuths and investigators. I wasn't fully a part of that. And I have his real confession now in the book and his official statement. And there's things that he has never said, even to these other people over the last 2 years. So this book is by Joseph Burns. I published, I helped ghostwrite, but he is the byline. This is his story.
Right. I mean, he's not a writer, so he needed someone to help,
right,
help put that together.
And there's other moving parts, right? It's not just him. There's 9 people at the house that night, 9 minus Kurt.
Okay. So who is Joseph Burns? Maybe we were getting ahead of ourselves.
Sure.
But who is this guy?
Joseph Burns was a rocker. He was a drummer, singer in Seattle. He was in a band called Aspirin Feast and a band called Laceration. And he was a rocker. He was a punk dude. He was a biker at one time. And he had some felonies. He was involved in the drug game, different types of drugs. But that's part of the story with Kurt Cobain. You know, this is who was at the house. Most of these people were drug users and dealers. Some of them were called nannies that watched Kurt and Courtney's child, Francis Bean. There's, you know, so basically Joseph is kind of like a smaller rocker than Kurt. Obviously, Kurt was worldwide, but at the time, and Joseph tells us in the book, Kurt wasn't well known when he met him. And Dylan Carlson, another rocker from a band called Earth and Kurt's good friend, said to Joseph, my friend wants to meet you. He really likes your band. That was Kurt Cobain. And that's how he met him. He met him in about 1989. It was about 5 years before the actual demise of Kurt.
So he's a rocker. He's a Seattle rocker, not as well known as Nirvana and Kurt Cobain, but they were in that circle.
They
were sort of in that party circle. And was it normal that they would hang out?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we talk about the Jesters of Chaos. We talk about other bands, the punk scene, how grunge kind of, if you want to call it grunge, they like to call it different names, and how that the heavy metal and the punk kind of became grunge, and grunge had that pop feel to it. And that's what Kurt mastered. Right. And Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Alice in Chains. And there was a lot. This was a big
Stone Temple
era.
Pilots and
Stone. Yeah. Oh, so many of them, you know, Queens of the Stone Age, Screaming Trees. And that's going to be an important thing in this story today is one of the lead singer of the Screaming Trees. But they all hung out. They all knew each other. And unfortunately, most of them were addicts, were heroin and cocaine and alcohol abusers.
Did they share similar like drug dealers and all of that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And in some of the stuff in Joseph's book, and we're allowed to say some of these things and also some recordings that we have too. You know, the biker mentality was kind of big too. The biker gang, the drug dealing, protection. A lot of people went down. A lot of soldiers fell of drug overdoses, murders, even in Seattle and Portland, LA. We know this time in the 90s, this was a crazy time period. So they were all mixed up together. And Joseph and his girlfriend were involved in basically dealing also heroin to Kurt Cobain.
So maybe, I guess maybe we should just jump to the time period when he dies. What was happening maybe in the days and weeks ahead of time, and how does Joseph relate to that before his death?
Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff going on. We won't be able to cover it all, and I'll just keep it kind of brief. It's 30 years of moving parts, 9 separate people squealing on each other loosely in other books. It's a lot of stuff. basically, if we just pick it up from having a lot of people there at the house, there was a intervention done with Kurt a few days before. He had tried to cancel Lollapalooza. They wanted to pay him like $9 million. He said, I don't want to do it. Courtney was kind of upset. The band was upset. Geffen Records, Golden Mountain, I think was the name. Gold Mountain, one of them. And so there was this intervention, and Kurt had gone down to LA, and Courtney went down separately also with the child. And Kurt was to go to rehab. He lasted about a day and a half there and then came back to Seattle without anybody knowing. And that's when this whole journey was triggered. He comes back, basically, it's late at night on April 1st. And then from April 2nd to April 5th, this is a window of key days where these people are interacting with Kurt Cobain, and eventually he is murdered.
Okay, so he leaves drug rehab in Southern California, flies back to Seattle. He's back there on April 2nd. He dies on
April 1st.
They find his body on April 8th.
Yeah, he lands on April 1st, and then he's at the house. This is just one of these magical things, but at 1 a.m. he arrives home. It's actually April 2nd, okay, just to keep it because people will pick this stuff apart. So, now his body is found on April 8th. The coroner and the investigators, the Seattle PD, say he dies on April 5th. Okay. In our book, in Joseph's statements, his confession, Kurt is killed on Easter Sunday at around 2 a.m. That's April 3rd, 2 a.m.
April 3rd. So his body is found 5 days later.
Yes.
Okay. So April 2nd, he gets in at around 1 in the morning on April 2nd. Mm-hmm. What happens after that?
So, I mean, I'll give you kind of the brief version, and then I can not, if you want me to talk about the murder and the staging of the suicide, ask me that separately. I'd like to just, I don't want to blend them all together, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. So let's just talk about him coming back. There's already people in the house. Joseph's there, his girlfriend, a girl named Jen Adamson.
And I'm sorry, if people don't know this, whose house is this? Does Kurt Cobain own the house?
Kurt's mansion.
Okay.
On Lake Washington in Seattle. I think the address is 171. Yeah. And so when he comes home at 1, he's tired. There's people there. They're shooting up. They're drinking. They're smoking weed. Some of them are playing music. Some of them are doing tattoo work. They're all kind of artists. A lot of these people are very interesting. Some went on to be designers, rock journalists, famous people. A lot of these people are very well known today. And so Kurt comes home and there's people already at his house. They don't really know he's coming. Some do, but some don't. And I initially, in my investigation, from what Joseph had told me in the very beginning, that Kurt was murdered right then within hours when he came home. Okay. Things have changed a little. He's hidden things, other people. And this was part of an investigation. I'm not always going to have every detail correct. So I'll be the first one to admit in my first interviews and first statements and stuff about the case was that he died on April 2nd. Okay. I'm off by a day. All right. So the next day comes, the next morning, whatever. Some people say they see Kurt. Oh, he's saying to me in the bed. They're saying he's still alive. We didn't believe them at first through the books. And so some stuff happens. I don't know everything that happens on April 2nd. And then we lead into April, the night of April 2nd. Now we're going to lead into the early morning of April 3rd, and this is when everything goes awry and three men show up at the house just like barnstormers, and it happens right there.
So we're like a 24-hour period. He's home at 1 in the morning. Does he go to sleep? Is he awake? There's people in his house kind of the whole time.
Yeah.
Through a whole 24-hour period, and then into April 3rd. Is it early morning hours? Are we talking like 2 in the morning, 3 in the 2 morning?
We're talking 2 a.m. when the deed is done. And these people stay there. This is going to sound crazy. They stay there for another 2 days while his body's in the greenhouse. Yes.
So these three individuals show up. So Joseph saw these three people show up?
Oh, he knows two of them very well. The other one is a little gray and hazy. But we do name that person in the book. The third, there's two main killers. Okay. I can name them because they're in the book. It's up to you. If you don't want me to name them, if your lawyers are like, don't let Chris Todd say their names.
If you've been seriously injured, your case could be worth millions, and you should know exactly what your rights are. That's why I want to tell you about Morgan & Morgan. They're America's largest injury law firm with over 1,000 attorneys working in all 50 states. And unlike a lot of firms that settle quickly, Morgan & Morgan doesn't take lowball offers from insurance companies. Just in the past few months, they won $12 million in Florida when the insurance company offered only $350,000. And in New York, they secured $6.8 million on a case where the offer was just $275,000. And the best part? It's absolutely free unless you win. Insurance companies try to pay out as little as possible. Morgan & Morgan fights to get you more if you become their client. It only takes a few minutes to see if you have a case, and you can do it right from your phone. It's that easy. You can visit forthepeople.com/redacted, or you can click the link in the description to get started. How about this, Chris? They can read the book if they want to get the names. You've written the names down. It's in the book. And
absolutely.
You name names in the book.
Yes. And I can say that one of the men, I can say their first names, right? I'll say that Dylan and Mark. And Mark is a, we didn't know this for a long time. And this is really one of the hooks in the book. The gotcha moment is this guy, Mark, who people will look up, who will know from the grunge scene. He is a famous person. He died a couple of years ago. Dylan is still alive, and the other third guy has died this year. So one of them is alive, but it's a fascinating story about Mark and Kurt's relationship as very good friends. And all these guys used to cross-dress together. They wore the lipstick, these famous pictures, and there's photos of Kurt with these two men, and they're online, they're photographed, they're wearing dresses. This is what they did. It wasn't like as if they were bisexual. It was more of a punk rock thing. And this shows how ahead of their time these guys really were. This was not really going on in 1994. So.
All right. So back to the murder. Why did they kill him? What do we know what unfolded that led them to kill Kurt Cobain?
There's a lot of different reasons. If we look, was there jealousy between Dylan and Mark and their bands? They were smaller time guys. They don't have a lot of money. Kurt's this big famous guy. They've been with him for years. They've seen him like his trajectory, right? We're not going to talk about some elements of motive because I know certain things I can't say about other people. And the book, like we said, it focuses on what Joseph sees. Okay. It's not about what are they thinking. One thing that Joseph does talk about in the book is, and we use these kind of little terms, the knuckleheads, the Three Stooges, the Three Musketeers, kind of saying like, these guys came there and were up to no good. The moment I saw them come in, oh, hey, what's up guys? What's going on? The looks on their face, they were not there to party. They were on some type of weird mission. And that's how Joseph describes that because Joseph had been in the game, a felon himself. So he knew, as he calls them licks in the book, I've done this before. I know that look. And I was fascinated by that. I said, man, just tell me more, man. He's like, I knew right away they were up to no good. Where's Kurt? In the basement. What's going on? And he follows him down to the basement.
And is it presumably, oh, they're up to no good. They're coming to rob the place. They're coming to
steal
drugs.
Joseph does not know. Joseph has no idea what's going to happen here in about 10 minutes.
So he just sees that their faces, they're up to no good. They're on a mission. They're not here to hang out and party and play music. They're here to do something. Where's Kurt Cobain? So he sees them with his own eyes come in.
Joseph.
And then go down to the basement.
Kurt's in the basement with two other women. Yeah. He's playing
okay,
like
walk
his
me
guitar.
Through that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of people in the house. And as Joseph says in the book, and we put this in the prologue, he's not going to remember what every person is doing every minute, what room they're in. So he's trying to say, like, give me some leeway. Just take a breath. Okay. Because a lot of these true crime people, they're like wolves, man. Like, and oh, he doesn't know where, Jessica Hopper was? Oh, why? Well, he doesn't remember every single second of what all these people are doing. This was a traumatic experience that he buried for 30 years. Okay.
Also, not to defend him, I don't know him.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've been to parties, college and otherwise, where you've been there at 2 a.m.
Right.
And I don't, you know, God knows, you know, 2 a.m, you're going to remember every detail.
You don't know where. I mean,
unless he was sitting there meditating and not having any alcohol or anything at all.
Oh, no. He was up for days. This is heroin use, drugs. He said literally he didn't sleep the day before at all. So, and the way it happened so fast, the way he tells the story, and he tries to protect the girls when it's happening in front of him. He hid this for a long time. He never told anyone this ever. I'm the only person he ever told it to. He told some other things to people over time because they were trying to help him. They tried to do like a GoFundMe page. He was like borderline homeless at one time. So, but let's just stick to the moment. And they come in. He doesn't really know this third person. He knows the other two. He knows Dylan and Mark 100%. And they race downstairs. He follows as if like, what's going on? And then when they get down there, there's an assault of Kurt Cobain. And he is hot-shotted forcefully.
Okay, what does that mean? Sorry, he's down there with two women. He's playing his guitar with these two women.
Yeah, he's just hanging out, smoking weed, drinking beers. You know, Joe's girlfriend is down there, and another girl that has a famous brother that I won't say the name this second, but she died. She actually died in 2000 of either a hot shot or of an overdose. Hot shot meaning hot loads of heroin can either be dirty heroin or excessive amounts. So hot shots, hot loads, they overdose Kurt. They force him. They already have these pre-made syringes already done up.
So they force him, and Joseph witnesses this.
Yes.
Joseph witnesses these three individuals forcing him to overdose on heroin.
Mainly Mark and Dylan. The other guy, okay, we can say his name, Danny, because everyone's kind of a fan of his story. He passed away this year. He's honing in on Mark and Dylan because the things with Danny, doesn't have a hard confirm that's him, but he can't rule them out. And there's a lot of weird stuff Danny said over the years and recently. So we've left him in there. But it's mainly these two are assaulting Kurt, trying to hit him with something. He's confused about like whether he's being punched and held down or they're grabbing something. He's literally kind of in shock. Okay. He's in shock of what he is witnessing. Now, Joseph also has a regret. That's why the book says my 30-year journey of regret, pain and disaster. He should have helped.
Well, and the title is To Kurt, I'm Sorry. What is he sorry about? That he didn't stop it?
Correct. Because, I mean, think about it. He was good friends with Kurt. You know, he loved Kurt. And I think Kurt loved Joe. And it'd be like you witnessing your friend, who is a very famous person, basically be assaulted. Now, remember, at this time, it's not like he's watching a murder. If they're injecting him, they're not shooting him at this moment. So he just doesn't know what's going on. So he's got the girls. One of them screams. We talk about it in there. He's kind of pushing them back. And it's just, it's bad, man. It's bad. I feel for the guy. I deal with a lot of accomplices and witnesses for over 10 years. I know it's hard for them to talk about it. And then Kurt is basically dragged out of there. And he witnesses that. And he is dragged out of the house and into the separate greenhouse. And he knows that's where they are because he sees him in there when he goes in the driveway couple minutes after. He's trying to see what's going on, but he does not go in the greenhouse.
So he has an overdose. They drag him out of there. Is he dead at that point?
I believe, for me, because other people say different things, and based on the coroner and the whole investigation is a joke. I'm just sorry to say it. It's a joke. So the coroner doesn't say Kurt is deceased and it's a post-mortem wound. It's kind of left in a weird gray area. I do believe, based on the autopsy, based on other sources and people that have looked, I do believe Kurt Cobain was dead when he was shot through his mouth.
So he was probably still alive before he was shot.
Well, I think he's dead.
Think he's dead?
I think he's deceased, yeah.
Okay. So he may have had an overdose then, right then and there, dies. They drag his body out to...
Or he dies when he's at... Look, remember, this gunshot's not going to be heard for 40 minutes. So he could still be alive when they're dragging him, right? But when they lay him down in the greenhouse, he could die within 10 minutes. The amount of heroin he had in his system was 1.52 milligrams per liter. Normal addicts with a relatively normal tolerance can die at 0.3. Okay? So he has five times the amount. Kurt weighed about 140 pounds. Okay? And people try to argue like, well, he was such an addict. He had a high tolerance. Dude, there's addicts that die at 0.3, 0.4. He has 1.52. Do the math. Okay? And it's injected. It's not swallowed. They try to do all this misinformation, disinformation. Oh, a guy, you know, he swallowed a thing that would give him two grams. That's swallowing. This is straight into his veins. Okay? So he, I believe, is dead. There's not a lot of blood coming out of his ear. There is some blood, but I guess, you know, his head actually doesn't blow out, which I thought it would when I initially came out. I used to say that and people tried to rip me apart for it. I guess technically the pellets did not penetrate through his skull. So it's actually inside his head. It's disturbing. It's sad. It's a very sad story. And Joseph has had the courage to do this. So...
All right, so let's go back to they're carrying the body out. Joseph loses track of them at that moment. He's watching them carry Kurt out, and he doesn't stop it or interact with them.
Correct.
And then he comes upstairs, and he's – take me through the next stages.
Sure, yeah. After a few minutes, after the girls are freaking out, right, and he's freaking out, he kind of drifts outside into the driveway. This greenhouse is separated from the house. It's above the garage. So they're almost – perpendicular to each other. Okay. They're like side by side, adjacent, whatever. He finally goes out. I'm going to smoke a cigarette. They don't know what's going on. The other people in the house, he can't really remember what they're doing. He believes there's only the three guys in the greenhouse. When he goes out to the driveway, he sees some motion. Okay. He can see, he doesn't see clearly. Remember, it's 2 in the morning. He sees movement up there, and then he hears a gun blast. Okay. At that point, as he talks about in the book, part of the regret, should I have gone up there? And partly what we talked about with him, or I did, and I said, let's say it a certain way, but tell me what you're feeling. Try to go back. He said, do you think I'm going to walk in there and they're going to kill me too? And I said, I get it. Okay. He's like, I'm not trying to get killed. Okay. Obviously something happened. All they have to do is turn the gun on him. He walks in. What's going on? So obviously Joseph had his own history of being in, you know, criminal circles and knew I'm not going to walk in there. And I tried to, you know, stick up for him and say, I get it. They're going to understand, man. They're going to feel for you, you know? And then after that, a little later, he then sees Dylan and Mark in the house. And it's very strange. About, you got to get out of here. You don't want to deal with this. What's going on? Where's Kurt? Oh, man, just, you know, like they're not saying it to him. And then he eventually goes and looks at the body kind of hours later when everything kind of is like settling down. And he never told anyone this in 30 years. He eventually goes and looks and sees Kurt in the greenhouse, deceased.
So these two guys, they're kind of saying, well, you don't really want to know. We're not going to tell you. It's you don't need to bother about it. Where's Kurt? You don't need to bother about it. It's like 3 in the morning at this point,
Or later, 5 a.m., 6 a.m. They're all there the next day too, because there's a key thing that happens on Monday. That's when Joseph leaves, is actually on Monday. All these people stay there and they're still shooting up and they're drinking beers and they're, I don't know. I don't have the answers of why they're all staying there.
It's crazy. I mean, it's just like a flop house. It's just like a drug flop house. I mean, I've covered these things in the news where just people are in these random houses and they're there for days. You know, they're sleeping on the floor, they're sleeping on mattresses, and they're just there. And it was sort of an open revolving door policy to have people just flowing into your house. So, but I think it's very important. Joseph then admits 30 years later that on, I guess it was that Sunday morning, or I guess it would have been Easter. Sunday morning, Easter Sunday, he tries to go and find Kurt at some point, maybe 3, 4, 5 in the morning.
Right.
And he goes up to this greenhouse and he sees the body.
Yes. And he didn't tell people this for 30 years. And he didn't ever mention Mark's name for 30 years. He never talked about any of this for 30 years. So, And look, I've asked him many times. People ask me a lot, like, can I talk to Joseph? No. Well, I want to talk, with me and gently, you know, because they're coming at him. He's got groupies and they offer him money. Come on, man, it's Kurt. Dude, this is traumatic. This is a dark story. There's legality issues. Okay. There are criminal elements, okay, between a witness and an accessory, okay? There's a very fine line. He's had the courage to do it. That's number one. But yes, he finally admitted, I saw him in there. I didn't see his face. I didn't look in. I didn't go in. He's trying to, and if he went in, maybe, I don't know. But I'm saying he's kind of keeping that buffer of like, I saw his shoes. I knew how he tied his shoes, okay? And then when you look from the back, you see his shoe facing you, not the sole, the front, because that's the back. You can't enter from the front. There's a balcony. You have to come through the back. There's a French doors. That's where the police bust in. They go through the back door. His feet are away from us, towards the front. Okay. So that's what he says. I knew how he tied his shoes. And I, you know, look, this could go on for hours. Obviously, there's a lot of things racing through his mind, right?
Yeah.
At that moment, now he officially knows one of his very good friends, one of the top rock stars of his generation, just got killed while they're there. That's a problem for all of them, not just the two plus the one guy, the other six of them. Okay? So
then he takes this. He doesn't say a word about it.
And no one else does either. That's important to know. None of these people have talked. None.
When they find, you talked about the staging of the what you believe to be a murder. What do you mean by that? How was it staged? What did the police find on the 8th of April? So now this is 5 days later.
Yeah. I just stick to the key things that, to me, I'm not a cop. I'm not a lawyer. We get it. I am an investigator. It's what I do. I've been doing it for over 10 years. I like to think I'm pretty good at what I do. There's a couple key things that should have set off red flags to the police. They called it a suicide within the same day. That's a problem. They had no fingerprint analysis results from the gun, the pen. You know, the pen was stabbed through a suicide note, supposedly into a potted plant. They don't test any fingerprints on the gun case, the shells, the box of shells, all this stuff. Okay. There's cigarette butts, you know, there's no touch DNA. So
can I ask you, all these years later in the cold case, are these pieces of evidence still being held in evidence?
Yes.
Do they still have the gun? Do they still have the shell casing? So they could do DNA tests on them all these years later.
Absolutely. But they closed the case at 5 p.m. on Friday. And that's where they made the mistake. They had no toxicology report back yet. Okay? None. And they had some weird rule, like the beat cops can say it's a suicide. And if they say it's a suicide, the detectives are off the case. There's some weird, they try to play this game at the Seattle PD. It's just disturbing. There were a lot of detectives there. Detective Cameron was one of the key guys. He died years ago. And even the coroner had died in a paragliding accident accidentally years later. Let me just say some of the key evidence, because people like the details in this, in the forensics somewhat. You have a man with a gun laying on his chest. Okay. The way he falls looks strange. First of all, he's holding this gun and they try to say, oh, he had a death grip. So when he's seated, when he goes back, he tenses up and he holds. That is not true. That does not happen in every death that the body seizes. That's not true. This was perpetuated for a long time. Go watch other murders. Watch. The bodies don't all seize up when they get killed. Okay. So he's holding this thing. The way he's holding it's weird. The way his body is sitting is strange. The gun is turned upside down. The shell that should come out of the ejection chamber is on the wrong side. On the wrong side. So if he had held it the way he did and he popped it, that gun has an automatic recoil ejection. The shell should have shot out to the correct side. It's on the wrong side. That's one of the biggest pieces of evidence that this is staged. Okay?
Right, because, well, I'm just picturing it in my head. If someone is holding his head and pulls the trigger, the shell goes out one side. If he's doing it in the reverse and doing it to himself, yeah, it would go out Correct. The opposite direction. Correct. And if you're high, drunk, and on drugs at 4 a.m, maybe that's something you don't think about.
And I also believe, to me, this is my theory, I believe they put it against their shoulder because now there's some evidence that this type of gun, if it's not shouldered or has something to bounce off the back of the stock, it will not eject the shell. A guy's been proving that. He's been holding the barrel and just shooting it, and the shell stays in. You have to rack it. Okay? So what he's trying to show is, if Kurt's sitting up and there's nothing, and he's like holding it, is the floor, wouldn't it slide on the floor out of his hands and he falls back like this instead of him still holding it like that? So the point is, the shell is supposed to eject, but they're questioning, did it even eject at all? But what I'm saying is, when they lay him down, they just shoulder it and they sit on him and they shoot him. Then they stage, and obviously they're wiping this thing down because there's no fingerprints found on the gun, not even Kurt's. So they obviously, whether they're wearing gloves, whether they're wiping it down, look, DNA is not a huge deal in 94. They're not thinking about too much of that. Fingerprints, they should be, and the pen's wiped down. So they obviously are staging this in more ways than one. They put the Barks root beer there. They put the little cigar box with the needles with the caps on them. Okay, there's a spoon with some black tar heroin in there. They leave that there. They're staging this. And also, I'll say this. How many cases have you ever seen where the suicide victim has the receipt to the gun in his pocket and the receipt to the shells in a bag by his foot? Okay? You don't see that. Okay? When people commit suicide, they don't say, yeah, here's the receipt. Now I want to show you. Here's that's in my pocket. And then look by my feet. There's a receipt to the shells. It's a setup. It's staged. And all this stuff needed to be red flagged by the Seattle PD. Not right away, but come on, man. This guy is like a hero to half of Seattle. And you're just going to write it. Yeah, suicide. They're doing interviews. Courtney's reading the letter pretty fast after that. MTV, he did this. He did this. They're all crying in the park. Come on, man. Yeah, you violated this guy's civil rights. You dragged this guy's name through the mud for 30 years. You called him the poster boy for suicide. There were copycat suicides. It's disgraceful. I'm sorry to get fired up about it, but it's unacceptable. And I'm not saying they're going to reopen the case. I'm not saying you should reopen the case. It's a story, okay? And it's for Kurt, okay? That's what it talks about. That's why it's to Kurt. I'm sorry.
The suicide note is interesting, too. I remember when they released that. And it said something like, I'll be happier. I love you. I love you.
Yeah, you're better off without me. Well, I'm telling you right now, we believe Kurt did not write those last four lines. They are not in the same font. I mean, they're not in the same handwriting. And they've had multiple handwriting experts look at it. There's some press out there that Jason Jensen was able to get out. You can go look him up. Jason has his own take and what he's doing too. And he had a report done. And they believe that those last four lines are not Kurt writing that. They're not the same sizing. The spacing is different. It is off. The letters are not the same exactly. And Kurt's letter is not suicidal. He's talking about faking it. I just want you guys to all know. Yeah, because he's trying to break up Nirvana. He wanted to do his own solo thing. Joseph talks about that. He wanted Joseph to play with him. Let's do something with your band too, man. Nirvana, the whole thing. He punched Chris Novoselic in the face. days when they tried to take Kurt to rehab before Chris drove him to the airport and Kurt punched him in the face. That's his bassist of Nirvana. There was a lot of problems. They canceled Lollapalooza. Everybody was mad. He lost money. Okay. The European tour, they looks like they gave him Rohypnol and tried to kill him in Rome. He was OD'd and he woke up and said some weird things to people. And the doctor said he didn't think he was suicidal. Look it up. Rohypnol, Rome, weeks before.
Wow. And so were these individuals that are referenced in the book that Joseph names, have they ever been investigated at all?
None. Zero. And
one two of them are now dead.
At least three of them are deceased. Yes. One killer, one accomplice, one witness. Yes. Three of these nine are deceased. There's six left.
What do we think the motive was in... If they were coming there with a mission, what do you think the motive was?
Well, that's why I have to be careful, because if I try to say, like, were these men told to do it and were they offered free drugs for the rest of their life, I have to be careful how I say that. To me, and in my investigations on a lot of cases, I don't care so much about motive. A lot of people, you know, this recent stuff in the news with the shootings, what's the motive? What's the motive? I don't care. I don't care what their motive is. They did something not only bad, it's really the worst thing you can do in life on this planet is take another person's soul. Okay? It's literally the worst thing you can do. You could have a bunch of different excuses. I really don't care. So whether they're jealous of Kurt, whether someone told them to do it, whether they were aided and abetted, okay? I'm not going to talk about that too much. And in the book, we only address that for a very brief moment. We're only focusing on what happened there with the people that are there.
So where do you go from here with this? Are any indication that police will reopen an investigation with all of this evidence?
I mean, do you want my personal opinion, my professional opinion on this?
Sure.
The case is over. This case is closed. This is a story. And this is for Kurt. This is his swan song. This is his goodbye. This is him talking through Joseph. If these other witnesses want to come forward, they can too. I'm sure they have their own version of the story. One of them sort of wants to talk. We've had conversations with them. They're a little hesitant. That's up to them. The book is out there. It's only like 7 days old. This is it. Okay. Whatever the other people want to say, that's for them. But I believe this case is closed. Do I have some 2% hope? Sure. They opened Keefe D, right? They did the Tupac thing in Vegas. The Vegas PD had courage to do it, get some press. I offered that to Seattle PD and they laughed at me. I'm sorry. I'm not going to help you like that. It's just unacceptable. And they've had a paradigm in their head with this. I think they didn't like Kurt Cobain, to be honest. I really do. I don't think they liked him. He had dark lyrics. He was a heroin user, drug user, artist. They hated grunge. They hated heavy metal, the punk rockers. They thought some of them were white supremacists. Hard to say that word. There was a lot of stuff. They saw it. Hey, there's a guy, gun there. Oh, there's a note. What do we got? Oh, there's a note. Look at this. That looks good to me. How about you guys? Yeah, pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, the note is interesting to me on a whole other level. So it's like they basically co-opted a note that he was writing and added to it to make it seem like a suicide note at the bottom.
Kurt was always writing. He had all these weird little letters. He wrote letters to Courtney. This was on the back of an IHOP menu. This guy was an artist through and through. This guy was a genius. If you really listen to his songs, he was a genius, okay? Imagine what he could have done. He was 27 years old. This guy worked really hard to get where he was. They were not known. They went through like three drummers. They had different band names. So we're to believe Kurt Cobain, and he has a child, like a 1.5-year-old, and he's going to take his own life? Yeah, things were bad. Maybe Nirvana was going to break up. Maybe he was going to do something on his own. Yeah, John Lennon did stuff on his own too. Okay, so... We were deprived of this man's genius Okay. And I wasn't even a big Nirvana fan. Okay. I won't say who I was because they'll freak out. My point is I'm here to work for Kurt as an investigator, as a journalist, as a writer, to help this guy tell his story. So for me moving forward, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of people online. To me, I feel I've done all I can. And so has Joseph. From there, that's organic. And that is up to destiny in a way.
Well, it's a remarkable story I've never heard. I'm sure most of our audience has never heard it either. A lot of questions remain. We can't go through all of them, but I would encourage people to read the book, get Joseph's firsthand perspective on what he saw those nights and those days, those early morning hours, and what happened to his friend, Kurt Cobain. Chris, thank you so much. It's a remarkable story. Thank you for sharing it with me.
Yeah, thank you for letting us have a platform like this with your subscribers and audience. I really want to thank you. And Joseph, thanks you too. I did give a heads up that I would be talking with you, and he wanted to say thank you so much for allowing this.
Thank you.